everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
Well, good morning, Discovery Church. My name is Zach. I'm one of the pastors here, and so grateful that we get to be together today. Wanted to give a quick shout out to you moms in the crowd. Happy Mother's Day to you. I'm really grateful for mothers. You should be applauding. That's a good thing to applaud. Also at Discovery, I think we always love to make a point that there are some of us in the room who are celebrating Mother's Day without our mom, maybe for the first time, or maybe it's been a little while. Also, Mother's Day for many of us that have struggled with infertility is a really hard day. And so just as a church that really works hard to have a good theology of suffering, that a happy Mother's Day is a happy Mother's Day to some, and for others to just remind you, God sees, and He knows, and He's with you in it all. If you're new to Discovery and you're looking to get plugged in or just curious about like what other things are going on around here, those QR codes that are on the back of your chairs, you can click into those, and that's got all the events coming up. If you are looking for a place to give, that's all of that's there for you. And as we wrap up our series that we've been in for the last couple weeks called Name the Elephant, we've got a really delightful gift for you today. Our teaching today will be rooted in the book of Philippians chapter 4, starting in verse 10. It says this: I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned for me, but had no opportunity to show it. Not that I am referring to being in need, for I have learned to be content with whatever I have. I know what it is to have little, and I know what it is to have plenty. In any and all circumstances, I have learned the secret of being well-fed and of going hungry, of having plenty and of being in need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Last fall, I got a phone call from my brother, and he said, hey, you might be hearing from one of my colleagues. My brother teaches English down at Valor Christian High School in Highlands Ranch. He said, one of my colleagues pulled me aside and said, do you have any family up in the Broomfield area? And my brother Drew said, well, yeah, my brother Zach and my dad and all of our family, we're all from Broomfield. And he said, does your brother work at a church? I said, yeah. And he said, I've been going to Discovery Church for the last 8 years. And so I got to have coffee for the first time last fall with Brian Davis. And Brian and his wife, Melissa, have been coming here for a while. And over the course of this coffee, and I feel like this happens often, meeting with folks here around Discovery, I learned a few things about my new friend, Brian. First, that he's been a pastor. 8 years bouncing back and forth between Utah and Missouri. That's incredible. I learned that he has a Master's of Divinity, which is Christian seminary speak for like he's a big deal. I then learned that he's got a PhD in church history. And again, I feel like I have this experience often, like if you only knew who you were sitting in the room with. And all of a sudden I'm like, why do you go to this church, man? Like it was so delightful. At that point in the year, we were having conversations about what should we be talking about, planning the sermon calendar for the whole next year. And so knowing now that I'm sitting across from somebody who's been around the block and knows a thing or two, I just, hey, Brian, if you could pick anything, as a guy who's been around Discovery for a while, what would you want to talk about? And he rattled off right away, oh, I'd talk about the rare jewel of Christian contentment. And I was like, what does that mean? And he said, it's a book written by a Puritan. His name's Jeremiah Burroughs, and the title of the book is The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. So if you're looking for a book coming out of your Mother's Day, it's a brilliant one. But Brian's incredible. Melissa is actually out of town today. So Melissa, I did want to give a strong shout out. Brian would say she's the real intellectual of the family. She's with her mom, Becky. So hi, Mel. I hope you're having a great day with your mom. But as I was thinking about today, and we'll talk about why contentment is this finale to this series called Name the Elephant, where we've been talking about anxiety and shame and sexuality and loneliness and friendship. How does contentment fit the mold? We'll get to that in just a little bit. But it made more sense to actually have the PhD on this come and speak to us rather than me trying to like parrot and regurgitate as best I could all the things that I've learned from Brian on this. So I would love for you to give a warm welcome Discovery to one of our own. Please welcome my friend Brian Davis. Found it. Hey, buddy. Thanks for doing this with me today. This is a gift. It'll be more of an interview style sermon than a typical sermon. So I hope that this is a great gift to you. Brian, you made it. We're here. You ready to do this thing?
Yeah.
Okay, tell me about, we've talked a little bit about how does this topic bridge the gap between shame, anxiety, sex? How does the idea of contentment fit in to this topic of the elephant in the room for Christians?
Well, it's been kind of interesting because for the last couple of weeks, I think we could all agree that when we talk about elephants in the room, when we talk about anxiety and we talk about sex, pretty obvious elephants. You know, last week when Zach was talking about sex, I don't know if you guys noticed this in the middle of the message, things got really, really quiet and everybody was kind of leaning in and all of that. This elephant's a little bit different because this elephant is connected to those other elephants, but it's more of an inner elephant, one that you carry around with you. And so in thinking about this, discontentment or the question of contentment for us, I think is really important because our society is saturated with discontentment. It's one of the things that makes the wheels of the American world go round. We use it for ourselves. It's used against us. So it's a powerful, there's always this constant stirring and churning that's going on in our life, and the issue of our contentment is always there, sometimes very visible, sometimes behind the scenes.
Yeah. And I think, as we've talked about, I think I've come to see it more like, you know, like in Marvel movies, like the first couple movies that will come out, you're meeting these villains, but they're like kind of pawns in the scheme of the arch villain who's really the master and commander behind all the things. Anxiety, sex, like these are villains that we meet early on in the series. But I think contentment is almost this arch villain who's behind kind of directing all of these different things that are going on. And so in naming the elephant, I would go so far as to say, and you've convinced me well, contentment is one of the arch villains that we have going on. And to call it out, just like anything else in our lives, when there is a sin issue going on, when there's something really hard, just to name something is a big deal. To call it for what it is and cast it into the light. And now all of a sudden we can talk about it because we can see it. Today we're talking about contentment and discontentment. So we're also talking about Puritans. Jeremiah Burroughs is a Puritan writer. Puritans are kind of a funny and brilliant group of people, but they didn't have social media. Like they didn't have the sexual world that we're growing up in now. They're kind of squares when you read them. Why should we be reading and thinking about Puritans today?
Well, I think, first of all, yeah, they do have a reputation as kind of being like a cosmic killjoy. They are, if you go back to the world of like the 1500s and the 1600s, they always seem to be the person that's made fun of in literature. And I think the value in going back and looking at the Puritans, and really this is something that I would extend even to other people in different time periods in the history of the church, is that it's really helpful to walk in the shoes of another believer in another time. It's true, they didn't have social media. I don't know what they would have done with social media, honestly. They would have anathematized it. But I think one of the things that I think that's safe to say about them is that even though the avenues that discontent finds its way into our life are different, so we have social media, we have all these things that are bombarding us, those are just the channels that the enemy of our soul uses to get to us. The actual problem goes all the way back to the garden. And so I think these Puritans were really, really good at dealing with it. They're careful readers of scripture. So a lot of times in my devotional reading, first and foremost, the Bible is there, but I like to read people who are good Bible readers. And especially in this case, the Puritans are a great guide for that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, and I think that's a great segue. So Burroughs writes this book, The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. And really what he's doing is he's spending time looking at Philippians, particularly these verses we just read this morning,
right,
and he's just doing this deep dive. And he was a pastor. Tell us just a little bit about his bio.
So he spent most of his life in and out of, he was a pastor in England, and this is, you have to understand, this is the 1600s. And so he found himself in and out of favor with the authorities. And so sometimes he's an outlaw, sometimes he's not. But he had an extensive ministry, especially at the end of his life in the middle of the 1600s as a pastor in London. And so the book that we're talking about today actually got published after he died.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, let me, this is what he wrote the book on, let me read through this passage for us one more time. And just knowing that, like, where we're going is this idea of contentment. See what you latch on to of what's going on here in the text, and then we'll take a moment just to unpack what's this letter that Paul is writing to this church in Philippi. What's going on there? We'll start there, and then we'll kind of get more into this idea of contentment. So Paul writes this to the church. I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned for me, but had no opportunity to show it. Not that I'm referring to being in need, for I have learned to be content with whatever I have. I know what it is to have little, and I know what it is to have plenty. In any and all circumstances, I have learned the secret of being well fed and of going hungry, of having plenty and being in need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. All right. It's a familiar Bible verse. Reminds me of Tim Tebow's, you know, eye black going on. I can do all things. Tell us about this verse. What's going on in the story? And we can just bounce back and forth what we know of Paul in this book.
Well, yeah. First of all, I think it would be fair and I think it would be safe to issue a familiar Bible verse alert because there's oftentimes, and if this is you, by the way, please, please don't like go home and rip something off of your wall. Some of you have this verse maybe somewhere adorning the halls of your home or on your coffee cup or something like this. This tends to be a verse that people use to motivate them. It's kind of I live in the world of high school students. It's kind of the superhero verse. It's kind of the Jesus is a power boost for the difficult things in your life. So I think one of the things I would caution as we look at this passage is that it's certainly talking about Christ as a source of power in your life. It's true. But if we take a look at the larger context of what's going on, there's a lot more that's going on with the midst of this. At this point, when we find Paul, he's in prison. Yeah. And if you look at the first, and I'm a high school student. I'm a high school teacher. So I would give you homework at this point. If you were in my class, I would look at you and say you really should read the book of Philippians, because it starts out with Paul talking about the fact that he's in jail, and it's actually going really well. And because he's talking about his circumstances, and he says, look at what God's doing. All of the Praetorian Guard is hearing about the gospel, and God is working in a mighty way in the midst of this. So Paul's a persecutor. He's been a Pharisee. He's hung out with rich people. He's been beaten. He's been shipwrecked. There's all of these different things. He's got some credibility when it comes to talking about the all things part of this verse. I would say at this point, and we were talking about this a little bit, that sometimes when people read a verse like this, this verse has actually been used in some harmful ways, even in Christian circles, as kind of a way of looking at people and saying, well, whatever's going on in your life, you're just going to have to deal with it. And so one of the things I would say, and this is where people like Jeremiah Burroughs are really helpful, that if you're a Christian, this is not one of those passages where you look at it and say, okay, well, okay, sirrah, sirrah, whatever's going on in my life, I guess I'm just going to have to put a brave face on the whole thing. Burroughs goes in and he talks about the fact that when you're facing circumstances, it's very much okay to pray about them. It's very much okay to complain about them. It's very much okay to ask God questions about them and to try to better your circumstances. But the issue in all of that is, well, who are you going to be as a child of God and trying to follow Christ in the midst of that? And so this isn't just one of those things where you just kind of shrug your shoulders and say, okay, well, we're not going to do anything about this. So the word that he uses for contentment is actually kind of a funny word, because it's a word that has at its roots the idea of self-sufficiency. And so in a very strict and a very real sense, the only one who is truly self-sufficient in all the universe is God. And so as we wrestle with this passage, the goal of the Christian life is not for you to become self-sufficient so that someday you grow up and you look at God and say, I can do it myself, and that you're always kind of embarrassed when you can't. The issue is really more learning about Christ's sufficiency in your life. So I think that's a good thing. All things pops up a lot in the book of Philippians. This one's a tough one because we want a qualifier or an asterisk on it, but Paul's going to have us wrestle with the fact that everything that's going on in your life is an opportunity or a venue for Christ's sufficiency to show up. The other one, and this is another thing we've been talking a lot about, is that Paul talks about this as a mystery, something that he's learned as a mystery. And for our American sensibilities, that doesn't sit very well with us, because we tend to think in terms of, can I have a formula? Are there five easy steps? And even at the end of the service, we're going to put some things up on the screen where you can think about, and you can think about ways to wrestle with the issue of contentment in your own life. But the fact that it's a mystery tells us that we're going to run into at some point something that is beyond technique, and we're deep, deep, deep in the realm of relationship when we do this. So this is going to be a powerful thing. One of the most popularizers of the Puritans in the last century was a pastor by the name of D. Martin Lloyd-Jones, and he was writing about this passage that Burroughs is wrestling with here, and he says there's actually two ditches that we can fall into when we look at this passage. One part, and I think this is kind of the American thing that we like to do. Sorry, I'm picking on Americans today. But one of the things that we like to do is we like to emphasize the I part. The what do I have to do? This is me, and this is Jesus coming to help me in the midst of that. So this is kind of in our kind of self-help, personal optimization culture. This is a comfortable thing for us. We gravitate toward the I part. That's one ditch, okay? And I'm going to encourage you that we're going to try to find some balance in the middle of that, and Burroughs is going to help us as we look at Scripture, and because I don't think that's what Paul has in mind here, this is all about you. The other ditch is saying it's not about me at all, kind of a let go, let God, passive, kick back and relax kind of thing. In Paul's world, this would have been the realm of the ancient philosophy called Stoicism, and Paul's not going to be advocating that here. What he's advocating is something, since he's talking about a mystery, it's something more intimate than that. He's putting these two truths side by side. This is something we do, but he also puts it there that God does it. And you had a great way of thinking about that.
Yeah, Ashley and I took a ballroom dancing class a while back, several classes. And it's so funny, if you've ever done a class like this, or if you're a dancer, particularly in ballroom, when you have typically a male and a female, that there's a leader and there's the other. And If the other's job is just that they like limply just stand there, like that's not dancing. And if the leader is forcing every single thing, also not dancing, there has to be a sense of a responsiveness in the other. So as you move this way, I also move this way, or I intentionally move the other way. But everything that I'm doing is responding to what I see you doing. And you're not forcing it on me. You are beginning, whether that is through eye contact or whether through these subtle gestures, I'm beginning to let you know, here's what we're going to be doing next. And so when we talk about contentment, as it is this mystery, it's not a self-help book, it's not a, like, here's how to better your golf swing. It's this mystery that's embedded in how do you, as an individual person, the way that you practice contentment with the Lord will be different than the person next to you. How do you engage this mystery of responsiveness to him that isn't just passivity and I just fall limp in his arms, and it's also not, I'm going to force my way on you, but I know my place in the dance routine here, like I will follow your lead, and I am very locked in to everything that's going on. So Burroughs, as we get into this idea of like, what is contentment? If you're like, can we just define it? Burroughs actually gives a definition right out of the gate in his book that I think is pretty great. And Nancy, if we can put this up on the screen, let's just leave it there for a while. Burroughs says it like this: Christian contentment is that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of spirit which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. So when we think of contentment, sometimes this can bring like a don't worry, be happy mentality, like a Hakuna Matata type of thing going on. This seems to be pointing at a different kind of definition, that contentment actually is much more broad than just stick a smiley face on it. Let's talk about that a little bit. How is this different from maybe how our culture would define contentment?
Well, I think if you look at the definition that he gives, and it's kind of funny because he does it at the beginning of this book, and then 120 or 30 pages later, he's finally done talking about it. That's how meticulous these people are. One of the things I think that you see in there, if you're a careful reader of the Bible and a follower of Christ, is how much of the fruits of the Spirit bubble to the surface in this definition. You have gentle, sweet, quiet, gracious frame. And you see all of these things that if you read your New Testament, these are things that God is doing in you and through you if you're a believer. And so in essence, what happens with Christian contentment is that when Christ is your sufficiency in your life is leaning in the direction of the fruits of the Spirit. This is how the fruits of the Spirit show up in so many different ways. And I think that makes it different from the way that we do this in our culture, because in our culture, contentment is this very privatized, individual kind of thing. It's based on your preferences, based on your tastes. And I think one of the things that really marks this out distinctively that's very different is that if it's our heart that determines these things, the Bible warns us that our heart's very deceitful. And so even the very issue of what you think makes you content should have a question mark around it if it points you away from all of the things that God is claiming that he's doing in your life in Christ. So there is a mystery of this with God working in all of these things.
Yeah. And you, I'm going to steal this from you. This is Brian's idea, but this is just one of the first of many things that started blowing my mind as we were talking about this. Brian said, it changes the nature and priority of the questions we ask when we're looking at, I have learned to be content in all things that Paul's talking about. That as followers of this way, it begins taking the questions that we ask in our lives away from the why, like, God, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to somebody else? And it changes them into a who type of a question. Who are you and who am I? And that the nature of those questions shifting in the world of contentment, that is a significant shift for a human being.
Oh, I think that you're absolutely right about that.
Because
we were talking, when we were talking about it though, and in refining it, I'm always struck by how many times in the New Testament Jesus sends his disciples to a place where there's going to be trouble. We were talking about the him with his disciples in a boat on the sea. Yeah. He tells the disciples to get in a boat and a storm comes along, realizing that Jesus sent them into the midst of the storm.
Yeah.
And in doing that, the purpose of him sending them into the midst of the storm was that was the one place where he wanted to reveal something about who he is that they would learn no place else but in the midst of the storm. And so I think that there is that tension that's there, and that's that mystery of God at work in all things.
Yeah. So maybe one question before we go too much further into the day. If contentment lived on a meter of 0 to 10, with 10 being, I am overwhelmingly content in all things, maybe like Paul, as you're thinking about your week this week, how content are you? And maybe if you're willing to do a little extra work on that, where does your discontent come from? Maybe just hold that as we continue to go through the morning. I think there's so many things that make contentment hard to hold on to. I think some of it, we all have desires. And when those desires go unmet, biologically, like if I am hungry and I'm not getting food, my body will let me know. And discontent will biologically build in my cells. So there is this sense of a biological response we have as human beings, but frankly, it shifts a little bit when those desires become more than just a biological or a physiological desire. But when it's a conversation that I'm having with the Lord of, I have a friend and they're really sick, and so God, I'm asking that you would heal this friend. And then when that healing doesn't come, discontent grows a lot in me because I have this desire and it's gone unmet. I think it's particularly a problem in Christian theology when we haven't had a soul that's been strengthened by a really strong theology of suffering, that sometimes God will allow suffering. Sometimes he does send you out into a boat in the middle of the sea. And sometimes it's not God. Sometimes it's just we live in a broken world and there are things happening that I think even God would say, yeah, that's not exactly how I designed it to go. Those are the choices of broken human beings around. And so all of these things like pinballs crashing around a machine are all working to expose these desires that I have and ways that they're being unmet. And I'm left at the end of the day trying to wrestle that to the ground with a relationship with the God of the universe. And I think that's really difficult. So where else, any other thoughts on why it's so hard to maintain contentment?
Well, I think, do you want to talk about the all things part?
Sure, let's do that.
Yeah, let's talk about the all things part. I, I wonder sometimes if, I was thinking about this in my own life, that when we talk about the circumstances of our life, and maybe this is just me, but we kind of approach it as if we go to God with the difficulties that we have, and as if only if I could figure out the why of what's going on, that the circumstances themselves would go away. Kind of like if you learn your lesson, then God's going to move you on to something else. Kind of like levels in a video game.
Yeah,
or
like Mario and Luigi. Yeah, Mario, if I pass that level, then I don't have to worry about that boss.
And I think if you look at how, if we follow so many different people in the pages of Scripture, it doesn't work that way. We're kind of in the back door of the prosperity gospel there, that you know, you learn your lesson, you get your prize, you move on to the next level. And with Paul here, there's not, your contentment does, it's not like the stock market where things are up and things are down. There's a baseline thing here. Christian contentment isn't like other forms of contentment in the sense that you're figuring things out, and the more you figure things out, you really don't need it because now you're independent and you're in control of things. So I think if for those of you that are kind of carrying that burden around in you, that the idea that there's stuff going on and if I just figured it out, the clouds would lift. Instead of trying to solve the puzzle, like my encouragement, and I think that this would be something that you would read from someone like Burroughs, would be stop trying to figure out the puzzle and turn instead and start asking who questions. Christ, who are you in the midst of this situation? What would you have me do? Looking for the quiet in the storm in the midst of those things.
Mm, yeah, that's so good. And again, I mean, it harkens back to that. Like, you stop asking the why questions, and mm-hmm. it's really more about the who. And like, who are you and who am I in the midst of whatever's going on, not trying to solve the why, yeah. Well, and you'd mentioned this the first time we started talking about this, but, and you hinted at this at the beginning, this idea of self-sufficiency being this word that Paul is using there, that only Jesus, like only God is self-sufficient in the world. And so this concept of self-sufficiency, when we think about what it means to be a follower of Jesus, there's this idea in human development that the goal is to become independent. We've got some graduating seniors in the room. You are getting ready to go off to the next thing. And for the last 18 years, your parents have been breathing into you this idea of like, someday, go. And some of you as seniors are experiencing parents going, go, but like, hang on a second. And that's the goal of human development. The irony is that in Christian development, in spiritual development, it's actually a little bit different. You want to speak to this idea?
Yeah, I think that what you have is that the more that you grow in your relationship with Christ, you're actually growing in the direction of dependence, but it's going wider and it's going deeper. And so, and Paul also talks about this with regard to our love for Christ as well. All of these things, we're discovering dimensions of trust that are much deeper and wider than we would have seen before. And so I think part of the contentedness is that you get to a point, as you mature in your relationship with Christ, you realize, actually, I'm trusting him more. Not, I can do this myself, and you're embarrassed when God has to swoop in and bail you out. You're actually looking to him in all of your circumstances and saying, okay, I need you. I need you all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's so important to call that out, because I think there can be a sense, I've experienced this as a follower of Jesus, these times where I'm like, man, I just feel so needy all the time, that is a mark of growth and maturity. And so maybe an additional question that we can ask in the room today is, if there was a meter of your dependence on Jesus to get through a typical day, where would you be right now? And we'll talk a little bit about the discontentedness that Christian pastors in particular can breed. But I think there's something really to be said at looking at role models that you have in your spiritual life and wondering at how dependent are those people on Jesus every day. And I think you'll find this inverse, whereas in human development we're seeking independence, in Christian maturity we are seeking greater dependence on Jesus. I think that's just so cool. So, and again, it's this idea of dancing all over again. Like, the longer we're dancing, the more in tune I am with what's going on, and the more I need Jesus to lead the dance, and the more that we can do in the midst of that dance. So, Western Christianity is where we live and breathe today. Do you think that Western Christianity promotes discontentedness just in how we live and breathe and do things?
Well, I think, and this is, and like for some of you sharp pencils in the room that are sitting there and tracking with this and trying to figure out, there's probably this question of, well, wait a minute, aren't there things in our life as Christians that we shouldn't be content about? And I think that this is where some of the mystery of that comes in, that the more content that you are with Christ, yes, there is going to be a form of discontentment that creeps in the back door, and it's the fact that the things that you thought made you happy, the things that you thought made you self-sufficient, suddenly lose their luster. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at them and you're going, well, this isn't, it's not the same anymore. The Burroughs calls it the vanity of things. You start to see the vanity of things, and the more that you, the things that you thought would satisfy, the things that you thought would bring you happiness, no, it's Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, too, some of us, me included, may have internalized this message of, like, if you're a follower of Jesus, grow. Like, the goal is progress. We see this in the world around us. How quickly can I be picking things up and growing in my spiritual walk? And I think that's another way where the church are growing up in a Christian home or trying to pursue Jesus. Like, you can feel this discontentedness, and rarely are you offered opportunities to just savor, look where I am right now. Can I just really enjoy the particular spiritual season that I'm in today without feeling like I've got to hurry up or learn the next thing or get to the next thing or progress? I'm just here. So we've got about 4 minutes left. So I'm wondering.
Let's talk about stuff at the end. Let's talk about ways we can go with this.
Let's hit evangelism.
The
evangelism.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that, I like I your hypothetical this. Question
okay.
for that.
We can be quick, I think, here.
Okay.
Okay, I want you to imagine this. You're new to Discovery. You just walked in the room, and every single person, you just are getting the growing sense, all of these people are deeply content. What does that do for this room? What would it do with our priorities in the church? I mean, it would probably freak you out, for one. Like, everybody's just eerily happy, it seems. But if you knew, the longer you were talking with people, there's a grittiness to them. Like, there's a long suffering that's behind this joy that they seem to be carrying. What would our kids learn if we were a community that we were all just content? What would your coworkers or neighbors learn about Christians if we lived that way? I think you should tell that story about Wesley and the Moravians real quick, and then we'll go to the last piece.
Yeah, you got a church historian. Yeah. So there's a story about John Wesley, one of the founders of Methodism, and he was traveling on an ocean voyage, and there was a storm. Once again, storms on the sea, common theme here. There's a storm that rises up on the sea, and he's freaking out, and he's wondering what's going to happen. Am I going to live through this? And there's a group of Moravian brethren on the ship that are singing and praising God and seem to be like eerily calm. And one of the things that he was wrestling with, the nature of his relationship with God at that point in his life, and he looked at that and he said, wait a minute, there's something there that I don't have. Because they're content in the midst of these circumstances. They're not playing mind games or anything like this. They're actually singing praises on a ship that might go down.
Yeah.
How does that even work? And so it caused him to hunger and thirst in a different direction, to look in a different, he's busy trying to do all these things to follow God. And it's like, well, where's the relationship part of this?
Yeah, yeah. It's this supervillain that kind of lives behind the curtain of a lot of things. And in the places where maybe in a political environment that we find ourselves in, you find yourself deeply discontented. Maybe it's with your body image. You find yourself deeply discontented. Maybe your inner critic runs haywire and you find yourself often so discontented. Your marriage, your friendships. I mean, it's this supervillain that just lives behind the scenes of everything. And we read this character who's literally in prison saying, I'm content, and I've learned to be content. And whether I'm in prison or whether I'm somewhere else, I just carry contentedness wherever I go. Man, that just seems like this sneaky invitation for us. So the remaining question for us is, how do we live this out in our day? Brian and I, just a handful of ideas we've scribbled on the screen here for you. We'll just talk about a couple of these real quick. But yeah, what jumps out for you here?
So I would say, since we've been talking about this form of contentment as being relational and a dance, that the role of prayer in the midst of this is really, really important. And so And this is something that I've been increasingly convicted over in the last few years of, and I don't know why it's one of those things where one day I'm reading the Lord's Prayer and I'm thinking, you know, I'm asking for the wrong things. I'm talking to God about my circumstances. I'm talking to God about my worries. And that's good. We know that he wants to hear those things. But when I know in the pages of Scripture that there are so many things that God is itching to give me, love, patience, self-control, kindness, why am I not praying in that direction? Because I know that he wants to give me these things. And honestly, and this, some of this is just reflecting on the Lord's Prayer, it's kind of changed the way I pray. Because I still pray about my circumstances, but what am I praying about my circumstances? I'm praying more, okay, in these circumstances, Lord, what are you doing in my life? And how can I be more like Christ in these circumstances, even if the circumstances themselves are not resolved to my satisfaction ever in the way that I thought possible?
Yeah. It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but one of the ideas up there is take a ballroom dancing class. And it doesn't matter if you're a male or a female, you will learn the dynamic of what's going on. And there's something strong to be said in the experience of realizing if I'm going to be a good dancer, it all becomes about doing what the leader is doing. So how am I responding to that? And it just becomes this great metaphor that to carry into the rest of your life. I think, did you want to say another one before I do this last one?
There's an idea, and the Puritans were big on this idea of the fact that remembering that you're a pilgrim and a stranger in this world is not your home. That if your attachment is to the kingdom that is coming, then what that does is that loosens your attachment to all of the things of this world that we're so, so head up about all the time. Because it frees you up, your horizon, and this would be in the Lord's Prayer, your kingdom come. Yeah. You're looking to the far horizon, and you're saying, "This world is not my home. I'm here. I want to serve Christ in the midst of it, but it's not my home."
I love that. Burroughs has this one idea in the book that just tickled me, and then it really messed with me for the rest of the week. He says, look, some of the work that we do when we're trying to engage discontent is we're trying to get rid of it and cast off this burden of discontent. Maybe one of the antidotes is instead of trying to cast it off, what if you took on an additional burden, which sounds very much like a Puritan. And he says, what about taking on the additional burden of confessing your sin? And his whole idea is the more that you engage how much you are undeserving, even of the breath in your lungs, the more it continues to lift your soul into this place of deep and abiding gratitude for what God's doing in and around you, everything that he's given you. So we've got all these ideas up on the screen. We'd love to offer you a contemplative moment this morning. And so we're going to invite the band back out, and they'll just play for about a minute here, but would just love for you to consider, where are your places of discontent? And where might God be inviting you into places of greater contentment? So take some time now. This is time just for you to offer back in prayer and consideration of where's all this landing for you. So take a moment.